Today on CyberWork, I'm joined by InfoSec CEO and founder Jack Koziel, and we talk to Ellie Burstyn, published author, speaker, and chief research lead for anti-abuse at Google. On the episode, we'll talk about the difference between the practices of security and anti-abuse, the difference between protecting Google the company and Gmail the product, and the aspects of security and anti-abuse that even AI will never be able to do. That's all today on CyberWork. Also, let's talk about CyberWork Applied, a new series from CyberWork. Tune in as expert InfoSec instructors and industry practitioners teach you a new cybersecurity skill and then show you how that skill applies to real-world scenarios. You'll learn how to carry out a variety of cyber attacks, practice using common cybersecurity tools, engage with walkthroughs that explain how major breaches occurred, and more. And believe it or not, it's all free. Go to infosecinstitute.com/learn or check out the link in the description and get started with hands-on training in a fun environment while keeping the cybersecurity skills that you have relevant. That's infosecinstitute.com/learn. And now, on with the show. Welcome to this week's episode of the CyberWork with InfoSec podcast. Each week, we talk with a different industry thought leader about cybersecurity trends, the way those trends affect the work of InfoSec professionals, and offer tips for breaking in or moving up the ladder in the cybersecurity industry. Today's guest needs no introduction, but that doesn't free me up from having to write one anyway. Ellie Burstyn leads the security and anti-abuse research team at Google. He focuses on deep learning and cryptography research, and among many other accomplishments, broke SHA-1. His website, ellie.net, E-L-I-E.net, is packed with informative articles and online talks he's given over the years, and is a veritable masterclass for any cybersecurity aspirants. Well worth checking out in your spare time. He also describes himself as a wearer of berets and a purveyor of magic tricks in his spare time. So we're going to talk about the differences between security and anti-abuse, the work he does at Google, and the skills and experiences our listeners would need to break into the fields of anti-abuse or cryptography. In addition, I'm happy to welcome back to the program InfoSec's founder and CEO, Jack Koziel. Jack has been following Ellie's talks since 2014, back when Ellie gave a talk about attacking Hearthstone, the game, at DEF CON, and has been eager to speak with him ever since. So in the next hour, we'll be covering lots of ground. Grab your caffeine of choice and get comfortable, because it's going to be a good one. Ellie, Jack, welcome to CyberWork.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Ellie, I want to start with the place we start on every show. We like to get a sort of origin story, superhero style. How did you first get interested in cybersecurity? What was the initial attraction for you?
Okay, I don't know if I can do the hero style, but I can try. How do I get attracted to it? I would say almost by accident. When I grew up in high school, I was mostly doing sports. I was playing water polo and, you know, not probably the most astute student you could imagine. And then turning after high school, my mom, which rarely have hard conversation with me, had one was like, no, you know, you need like a job to pay the bills. That's not going to happen. And you should get an education. She always wanted me to have an education. She dropped out of high school. So that was important. And so I did what I've been told, and I ended up in engineering school, which is for computer. And it was literally, oh, I like video games. Computer science seems pretty good. And I asked people around me, and like, yeah, maybe. So, you know, didn't really know about higher education or anything like that. So I you look in the paper and like, okay, it seems to be reasonable. Somehow, some way, I managed to pass the entry bar. And so I almost ended up there clueless, right? And then I've been working since I'm 16. And so I was a plumber. Right? So a plumber when you're 16 basically means you carry stuff from, you know, old bathroom you would redo down, and then you keep, you know, carrying stuff.
You're carrying the heavy stuff for the journeyman. You're the journeyman for the tradesman.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of my job, and it's a horrible job. It sucks. But you know, it's very formative, and you know, learn a lot of stuff. But I would go, like 5 a.m. on, you know, like social building and try to refactor them before people wake up.
Right.
But it's not the greatest, but I mean, pay is a bill. We needed money. So, you know, that's what it is. So then I was in engineering school, and now I have to go very, very early to school. And then I have to finish. It finished pretty late. It's pretty intense. It's, I don't know. So the early few weeks were like by design they are, but you know, it's 10 hours of work a day. So right. I need to still pay the bill, so I need to find a new job. And so turns out that one of the first early benefits I had to go to this kind of education was to meet people who say, well, have the same problem. Here's the thing. A lot of us goes and we do tech support. And I say, okay, what is it? And I say, well, it's very simple. There is this company at the time, you know, we're talking 1998, right? So it's a very, very long time ago.
Right.
DSL was being deployed in Europe. And so one of the early deployment ISP who deployed DSL called Club Internet in France hired people to help, you know, people get online and resolve their problem with their DSL cable, modems, and things like that. And so it's like, okay, you take call and then you do that Saturday, Sunday, and you do that on holidays, right? The equivalent of national holidays. And the pay is pretty good, right? And I would make more than I would do doing plumber, right? Or journeyman. And yeah. I would be able to do school during the week and work during the holidays and weekend. And I did that for about 2 years. Oh. And to be honest, that's probably one of the two most tiring years of my life, because you don't get a break, right? And yeah. I think at the end, when I stopped doing that, I had done more than 20,000 calls. Which is kind of, you know, I say you do like quite a few a day. I mean, I don't know if you ever call your ISP, but they try to get very, very fast. And we had, you know, target numbers on how many calls you would do per day and things like that. Like all things, by the way, I think it was a very good experience. Yeah. Got very used to talk, got very used to get understand over the phone line. So, you know, you get used to talk, you get used to slow down your pace, you get used to different intonation, understand better people, deal with people which are really unhappy. So I think it was really good. You know, it was not maybe the most pleasant experience for that. And so a lot of people in that thing were basically startup owners. So what they would do is they would work on the startup over the week, and then they would go and do this kind of work on the weekend, you know, to gig on the side, right? So I met a lot of very smart and interesting people, probably the smartest bunch of people I ever met in one go, at least at that point in my life. And one of them or two of them were very, very into security. I don't want to say the name, but let's just say they were quite involved in the security community, and they told me about FRAC. They do write for FRAC, which was in old easy. I don't know if you get covered that a long time in the show, but FRAC was a Bible where group would exchange tips and technical information, right? And so, and I'm like, what are you doing after work? And I'm like, well, we do this. And then I see people, you know, typing weird things into a computer, and things start to get funny. And I found that very interesting. And I'm like, okay, what are you guys are doing? And they try to explain to me that security and that actually program misbehave in a very, very nice way, right? Remember, we were sitting in each other. So, you know, that's like during lunch break or dinner break. We used to do also evening call support, right? The other break. And so that's how I get started. I get started because I met people which were kind of really good. I had an inclination for that. If you really want to go even deeper, my grandfather... My grandfather left Germany during Kristallnacht due to the Nazi, right? And so he entered the resistance. And I was educated to not take things for granted, right? One of the things he would always ask me, even before I do computer, would be how this work, and try to make sure you can always understand technology, understand what happened to you, to not be controlled by it. And I think that's why I like so much DEF CON, right? DEF CON being a big conference, I'm sure you mentioned multiple times. One of the tenets of that is you need to understand technology, or less the technology will control you, right? And that's something my grandfather always tried to teach me, was you need to understand the world and you need to understand things to avoid being controlled by it, right? It's very important for him and kind of in my DNA. I have a very vivid recollection of, I don't know, I was 12 or 13. And it's like, you know, one of the things which would be interesting, he told me, was probably we should learn how to hack a satellite. Probably a horrible idea, legally.
Not a bad idea.
But I think his point was along the line of, you know, satellites seem to be very important. He was a very technical person. Right. And, you know, that's something you should probably pay attention to, because it might be important, right? You know, GPS were coming online. Yep. TV by satellite was a big thing at the time. So I think it could make sense. So, but I remember even when I was 12 or 13, have this input from my grandfather of like, you need to understand things deeper. And I think security is this thirst of knowledge and this thirst of what's behind the scene, how this thing work, what is the limit of the system and what happened when the system breaks, right? And I think that's a mindset. So I grew up with a mindset, I didn't know about it, and then it was revealed. And then security started naturally because some of the people I told you had a side on gig, some of them took job into a famous pen testing company. Mm-hmm. And so after, you know, I learned with them and work with them on side project as we go along, I basically they invited me to do an internship there. And again, when you step up from tech support to be a security consultant, the pay goes up, right? And you get you feel like you are doing a more interesting job. So I learned a lot by being a security consultant for, I think, 6 months as an internship, and then was way better. And then from there, I naturally joined the lab of my school, which is a security lab, right? They had a security research. So the idea would be then I did not have to pay for education. I would just do help to teach security.
Okay.
And that's what I did. It was really interesting. And then very surprisingly, I think 3 months in, the person who was in charge of doing the course had other things to personal problem or something else to do. And so I ended up being in charge of doing the security course. And now you have one terrified LA who has to teach engineers how to do security.
Yeah.
And that's where I discovered, A, I love teaching. B, it's terrifying. And C, I had to learn a lot of things. And so I started to teach buffer overflow and format string bugs and, you know, system and hardware security. And then from that point forward, it became kind of my source of revenue, right? So I entered, that's how I entered the space and entered security education was by knowing people. And I think that's really the story of my life, which is I met people, and if you're open to changes and you're open to opportunities, they will come along. Sometimes it's not what you want, but there might be something which on the long run is beneficial to you.
Yeah. And I, you know, I want to just emphasize this. We talk about this a lot on the podcast, but the importance of the ability to communicate in a security sphere. And you said it yourself that you talked with a lot of people and you were able to sort of like talk with people at different sort of energy levels or people who had, you know, problems or might be, you know, having a, you know, in a bad place right now or whatever. And so when you do have these people that you meet, then having that soft skill of being able to communicate with them, like you're more likely to get that opportunity, as you said there. So, you know, it's not just about, you know, learning the tech of it. You really do need to be a people person as well. Jack, does this sort of line up with your sort of security story?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I think, you know, kind of coming into cybersecurity, you know, it wasn't even called cybersecurity back in the 90s, right? Like, you know, I think it's just interesting that you know, how you entered the field is very different than how a lot of young people are entering cybersecurity nowadays. You know, they're not, you know, they're not reading FRAC and they're not looking at, you know, BugTrack and, you know, all those things that were, you know, I thought really like a lot of fun and really draw you in. You know, I just wonder, you know, for younger people that are, you know, trying to enter the industry, you know, it's, in my mind, it's good and it's bad, right? It's more accessible. There's more information out there, but it's less personal. You know, there's not like a small group of people that are really invested in helping you learn, like there were back in the day. I'm just because I'm old and like talking nostalgic about, you know, the hacker scene in Chicago in the 90s that I grew up in. But I don't know, what do you think about that? Is that your observation as well with younger people that are coming into the industry?
It's a hard question, but I think in a way, yeah, things have changed. I think there will always be small community, and I think they still exist. It just happened that our field is so big that the community is not one anymore. It's just few of those. And sometimes they intersect, sometimes they don't intersect. I remember the old days as well, right? One thing I can say, and I don't know if it's very much public, but FRAC was never one group. There was a few groups, and FRAC started in the US, But at some point, FRAC was handed over to some people in France, some people in Germany at a different point in time. And so FRAC was never one group, right? It was a set of people. We didn't know the other group, to be honest. I know who were in FRAC France, or some of it, to be honest. Maybe some of them I don't know. I don't know we know everyone. I think, to be honest, very few people know who created FRAC. I do, but we're not going to say, but I don't even know if it's public. You know, and I think FRAC was this kind of decentralized, decentralized organization of like a group of people who started to exchanging on the internet because they found it interesting, and then groups started to create. They still exist. Like DEF CON, you know, we have the villages, right, which are essentially a special group of interest on security. The election security group is very tightly run. It's everyone knows them. Everyone who work on that would know Alex Alderman and Matt Blaze, which are kind of like the forefront of those. And but if you go to the car hacking village, where they do a lot of things on Teslas these days, they are a completely different group. I don't know them. I do know of them, right? And so I think you can get into car security very easily by entering that community. And so I think you're right. You did not enter the security community anymore. In a way, depending on what your career path is and what you want to do, it will make it something harder. It will make something easier. I think there is more room. So there's more opportunity because security is so pervasive. At the same time, if your goal is to be like the guy known for security worldwide, then I don't think it exists anymore. So, you know, we had people like this at some point. I remember Dan Kaminsky being probably the most well-known researcher, right? And he would go to Black Hat of DEF CON and the scene would be packed full, and then they couldn't accept people, you know. And it still happened to some of the talk, but we cannot pinpoint one person in security anymore, but that's okay. I think that's okay. I think we're just bigger, which is good, and we have more career paths, which mean more option with different sensitivity. So yeah, I don't think you're right, but I think there exists a community. They're just smaller. Or as you know, they are separated, which maybe is good, maybe is not good.
As things get bigger, it's harder to sort of maintain that sort of small community vibe, and you know, or as you say, you sort of it breaks into several other small communities that each are sort of specialized, I suppose.
Yeah, and we change, right? I think. Jack, when was the first time you went to DEF CON? But if you remember the very old day of DEF CON, I mean, it was by the swimming pool, right? And some of it were clearly non-politically correct. And I do think, in a way, yes, it's less personal because there's 20,000 people. You still can speak to the speaker. You can still go to the village. But I think it got better in terms of inclusion. It got better at making people feeling more welcome. You know, some of the traditions still remain, but they become optional. For our listener, if we don't know that, one of the traditions at DEF CON is when you do your first talk, you have to drink on stage. However, they change, right? And now you can also decide to not drink alcohol if you don't feel like it, which I think is better. I think it's an improvement, right? I think as we go bigger, we also get good practices and thinking from a lot of diverse people, which is really good. So I think it also incorporates this idea of, I think the spirit is still there. I think it just, we need now big and small scale events. So we're adapting. That's good. You know, podcast is a new thing too, right? I mean, security podcast, now there is a few. It was not a thing like 10 years ago. Like, why would you do that? So, you know, we evolve. It's good. I like it. I like the dynamic of the field. I think if our problem is we are growing too fast, we're in a good spot, right? That's a good field. If your good problem field to have. Is dying, you'll be like in a different position, right?
Right. There you go. So I want to jump into you know, the career aspects of your history here. Obviously, right from your time at Stanford in the postdoc program, you jumped right into working for Google, working your way up from research scientist to security and anti-abuse research lead. Can you start out? Can you tell me a little bit about the progression of jobs and responsibilities as you move through? Like, what, you know, because I think a lot of people who hear this are going to say, like, well, what is that? What's the difference between, you know, the research scientist to the sort of lead of the research department, things like that? Can you sort of map that out for me?
Yeah, I'll start briefly of how I ended up in Stanford and how I ended up in Google, just to give context. As I said earlier, I came to security almost by accident, and I'm not a very you know, I, it was not a career plan. That's very important, you know. I and so as everything in my life, I end up in Stanford because I did a PhD in France, and I did a PhD in France because someone I trusted told me you should do research. You seem to be fit for it. I didn't know myself, but someone, at least two or three people, came to me and said you should try. It was something I would never have considered. I didn't. I feel like an imposter, to be clear. And it was really, really hard. And I got very, very lucky to enter in a very, very good school. But to be honest, I felt completely at loss for the first year. I really feel like an imposter. And I didn't know, because they knew a lot of references and a lot of academic knowledge I never heard. So it was hard. It was very difficult. But then I found a paper that I found I liked, and then I found the author, and I don't know what the author was. And I just sent this person an email and I say, hey, I think I can work on that. And the person was really kind and say, well, okay, here is a problem you should fix, right? You know, when you do start research, and we might talk more about how you enter the career, but if you were to enter career research in security, you usually read a bunch of paper and you find one subject you like. And if the author is paper is well done, at the end of it, you have a discussion section. And the discussion section is, here's where we are, and here's all the things we don't know. And then usually you might find one and like, okay, maybe I can do that. And it might be simple as we're doing an experiment, it might be as trying this thing, or maybe going to that. And so you can get idea from the community. I think one of the quality of research papers, we encourage everyone to read them and not read the middle of it, but just read the abstract for the idea and read the discussion of what's next. And you know, if you do that for a few paper on the top conference, and we can cite Usenix Security, which is open source, free to download, or maybe some of the paper we put online. A lot of academic researchers do it, like I do on my website, as you mentioned, but that to get access to that to people, you know, there's a lot of discussion about open access for security research. You can read the discussion, you can read the abstract. So the abstract gives you an idea, expose you to new line of thought, and then the discussion section would give you idea on where to go. And that's exactly what I did. And I read this paper, and it's very arcane. It's about attack graph, which is using formal reasoning to do network planning and things like that. And I say, okay, there's a problem on how to do two player, which is an attacker and a defender. They used to do single player, and I'm like, okay, we can do two player. So I'm like, okay, I can maybe do that. I know how to code, and I can see maybe I can write a prototype. And then I didn't realize how much math it would be, of course, because I didn't know anything. But you know, I went with the enthusiasm of the newcomer.
Oh yeah.
And I just interacted with that person, and then comes the PhD defense. In France, you have to have foreign reviewers. So I invited this person, and she kindly accepted. And she's very senior in the US. At the time, she was rotating as the head of the NSF, the Science Foundations. And she kindly took the time, and she said, you should go to Stanford. They have a group which do something related to that. I used to do formal methods for security during my PhD, to be clear. And she made the introduction, and I got a job. And again, I never planned to go to the US. It was not in my mind. I never been to Stanford before. So I arrived in a new place on December, and that's where I ended up in Stanford. And then there, the group is incredible and very, very a lot of bright people. Also, again, imposter syndrome all the way up, to be clear. Really, really difficult for me. But that's what happened, right? And I got exposed to new ideas. The main one, I think, is web security. I did a lot of web security. I still do a lot of web security. This group was one of the forefront and still is the forefront of web security. A lot of the things that are still used, like CSRF defenses or a lot of work on XSS, has been done there earlier. And I got to be part of that. I got to jump on the train, and web security still remain one of the things I'm probably one of the most well-known for. I think we wrote the first paper on incognito mode for browser. So browser incognito mode, the first paper, and I on that was from the group, because we would work with Firefox, which was next door. We would work with the people who would become the core of the Chrome team before even Chrome was announced. So when you're in Silicon Valley, you know, you're next door to Google, Apple, and soon to be Facebook. I think we went to Facebook in the very early building in Silicon Valley. I think there was like 100 people, and we were talking about JavaScript security and sandboxing with them, and what research and what the social network would be. So you get exposed to a lot of things. So that's how I got into it. And then for personal reason, I had to get an H-1B visa so we can stay in the US with my wife. So short story is basically I was on a J-1 visa. She was on a visiting visa, and like a legal one, to be clear. And she go back to France for a wedding, nothing very out of the ordinary. And she come back, and then she got deported. And then can't go back to the US. And so the answer now is I'm stuck with finding an H-1B, getting married, or going back to France, or I don't know, breaking up. I didn't feel like breaking up, obviously. And I decided to find an H-1B. I wanted to stay in the US, and I felt that the US is the best place still for a tech company, right? So then, again, thanks to the people I met at conferences, I met a bunch of people in Iceland. Actually, the person who introduced me to the Google Research Group, Ulvar, I met him in a conference 6 years ago before I joined Google during my PhD. So, you know, very random, and you never know, right? You never know who you meet and how they're going to change your life. And like, well, maybe you interview with us and let me show you what Google is. And so I had to choose between, at the end of the day, I choose between Twitter and Google. And I decided to go to Google because I liked the diversity of product. At the time, we didn't have all those products, but we had quite a few. Gmail was still there. Search was already there. Chrome was booming. Android was just solid. I have somewhere in my closet the first Android phone. Sometimes I look at it, I'm like, oh boy, what a change.
Wow. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, so I chose a group where I felt there was the most diverse set of topic and mm-hmm. I could work. And I joined for doing web security and research, right? I was very much on the track of, you know, hard security things. I love CAPTCHA, as you mentioned. CAPTCHA yep. is something I personally was very intrigued about. What is the difference between human and computer, right? I mean, AI was not all the craze, right? You know, it was kind of this period where people say AI almost died. You know, there was a lot of hype until the 80s, and then in the 2000, until the 90 and 2000, it was like, okay, it doesn't seem to work, and a lot of setback before neural network kick in, and then, you know, things get crazy, like in the last 5 years where AI is all the rage now. But at the time, it was more like an intellectual interest. So I love that. I think people and academia was like, okay, you know, so I think what makes you successful is not necessarily what you like. That's okay. It's also like research. Sometimes you succeed, sometimes you fail. It's important to fail. It's important to accept that something you like, you work. Sometimes something you don't like, don't work. It's what it is. Very, very, it's okay. I mean, so yeah, so I did CAPTCHA and then did web security and then I joined Google. And so I joined as a researcher, as you ask. So what is a researcher? A researcher is someone usually who do a mix between industry and academia. So you would say someone which have a slant for building stuff and writing code while also liking to publish and to go to conferences. So that's what it is. I really enjoy going to conferences and doing like out of the box thinking. It was a time, for example, where because I was doing a lot of security, I finally got Apple to use HTTPS for the App Store. That was probably one of the most famous thing I did, was pushing Apple to use HTTPS. I had to write a proof of code where I can hijack the connection and literally install the app of my choice on an iPhone to get them to change. There is a video of that on my YouTube channel if people want, but that's a stupid thing. It's just like there is HTTP. You can hijack the stream and just say, hey, here's an update. And here's where you should download it. And you didn't check anything. And you're like, we probably should fix that. And it took like a year. But that's an example of where if you're interested in one thing, there is always something to find.
Right.
You just have to look, right? And again, we're back to security and this mindset of you want to understand how things work. And I was very interested into App Store security. We were starting the Google Play Store. I mean, the Google Play Store was fairly young. So we did a lot of research on what is a Play Store, how you deliver updates, things like that, right? Yeah, that was Google. Cool. So I started that. As I said, I went there personal reason, but also because I felt that I know my limitation. I'm not someone who grew up with academia in mind. I just learn it as a fly. So I wanted a place where I would be exposed to new ideas, new problem. And I felt that I could. I'm good at seeing a problem and finding creative solutions. That's really what my talent is. So I felt that it worked really well when I went to Stanford, really boost off my career to be exposed to new ideas and new things. So I felt that if I'm in a place where there's a lot of new things, then maybe I can do better. So I try to find a place which match my kind of where I'm strong, right? And I know that, for example, I'm not a big thinker. I know that. I mean, that's what it is. I don't have like big ideas.
You're more of a problem solver.
Yeah, I'm more a problem solver, but I am more an intuitive one where I seek more quickly, right. I think, than most people.
Okay.
How to go to the solution or to go about something. And right. So that's kind of where I shine. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you know that, you do that, right? One of the part of the security is how to turn the table and spin things in another way or apply A to B, right? If I do A to B, what it does, so it do, right? You mentioned that Jack saw my Hearthstone talk. That was just that. It's like, oh, I have AI and I have a game of card I like. If I bridge the game, the two together, what's going to do? I'll probably get Ellie banned from Blizzard for a while and then also probably your talk. And, you know, a lot of angry Twitter follower now because they started to follow me for games. And then now I only post about security.
We could probably just cut off the rest of this podcast and you guys could swap Hearthstone and early internet stories as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is, right? And yeah. So that's what it is. And so that's a researcher at Google is basically someone, whether you're in AI or you are in data mining or network or security, you basically are the bridge between industry and academia. And the way I would explain today, hindsight would be trying to unlock the next generation of capability to protect product and protect users, right? Google is very much centric around protecting user, at least, you know, and making Google useful to the world. That's kind of the overarching mission, right?
Yeah.
So then if you stay long enough, the team grew bigger. Google grew bigger, right? Google grew a lot. People might not remember that, but I mean, there was 15,000 people when I joined or something like that. You know, you might think it's big, but like we're really big now, right? So it was still very small. And as the thing grew bigger, we have more people coming in and the number of product explode and we start to have abuse problem, fake account, fake download, fake ratings, fake views, fake this, fake that. And so the team which do anti-abuse start to grow a lot, right? That was pre-G Plus era, and then with G Plus, whether ill-fated it was, it grew a lot. That turn on, you know, Google, which would become Google Photos, and you know, we have Drive, and we start to open it, and so it split. And then, as a result of that, the team grows, and then the person which was the director of it at the time say, "Okay, you seem really interested into abuse. I was working on Gmail and account at the time, and black market and." I know Jack had a question on that. And then we look at that, right? And so she's like, okay, would you like to build your own team who will focus on that? We think if you are closer to the product, you would be better doing research because you would be directly integrated with what the engineer sees as problem. And again, remember, I'm not a big thinker. I think I strive better with other people's problems. So I'm like, okay, that seems reasonable. Never been a manager, never understood what to be managing a team. Don't know how that's going to go, but I'm willing to try. I'm willing to learn. And again, I have the imposter syndrome, you know, and I'm there. And I got my first person who reported to me, which is a fantastic person. That's Kurt Thomas. He's a fantastic researcher. So I got really, really lucky to get really early on, like the first few people who work with me were extremely good and extremely nice. And to be honest, I was a horrible manager. I didn't know what I was doing. So I'm really glad they stuck with me. Kurt is still working with me, right?
And yeah, I was going to say, is a lot of your old team still with you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We actually really, really, one of the things we do really well is I think we only had one person who left the team bearing reorganization in the last 5 years. So we have an extremely high retention rate, which is important because research is a steep curve, right? To be clear, research is a steep curve, probably one of the steepest curve because you have to absorb a lot of things before you're even productive. So we like to have people around a long time. But then I got very, very lucky to get, you know, the right context, being on the fast growing side of the company and having like a lot of problem emerging. You know, what started as a team who was basically a team started, I forgot to mention that, as Gmail, right? Mm-hmm. The first need was a spam filter, phishing filter for classifier, whatever you would call it, who receive email and process them, right? That's why I like this team because, you know, hey, machine learning is something I loved all my life. I was always fascinated with capturing this idea I told you about AI and human. So I was very interested into security and AI, and Gmail was the biggest security classifier, I would say, or one of the biggest, at least one of the biggest at Google, I don't know, worldwide, but a pretty big one at the time already, right? And you had millions and millions and hundreds of millions of people already, right? So I thought that was a really interesting thing to work on. So that's what I did. And then what's the difference between then your manager, some people call that a tech lead. So basically, for those who don't really know how that works in big company, maybe I explain that real quick if you guys think it's useful. Mm-hmm. Big tech company, I think that apply to Facebook, Yahoo, Google, and a bunch of other have what we call levels, right? So levels will be start at, I think, 2 or 3 and then end up at something like 12 maybe, although they do not call that way. So you go usually on up to 9 and then become VP, senior VP, and then I don't know what's above senior VP, senior VP maybe. I don't have a name for that, but to hire for my paycheck. But yeah, the idea would be you start, so the when you're out of college, you usually are hired at 3. When you're hired out of a PhD, you're at 4 or 5. What's higher at 4? Right, so I'm a level 4, which is research scientist. So when I start to have my team, my own small team, and I become the equivalent of, in engineering, what you call a tech lead, TLM, tech lead manager. So the M is for manager. So this is a relationship where you have both a tech lead and a manager. So we can talk about work balance there, or technical versus management balance if you want. But the idea is like you have that, and then you would be around L5, and then you have L6, which is where the word staff start to be prefixed. So staff, you become staff research scientist, and then you become staff senior research scientist, and then that's L7, and then L8 is director. So research director for me, or director of engineering, or I think they call that principal engineers onto the software engineering ladders. I think it will be the same for a security engineer as well. And then, you know, different ladder have different expectations. So a ladder, what is a ladder? Sorry, I have to explain that. I'm sorry if I do take a lot of time, but it's kind of a little bit of a complex subject.
Yeah.
A ladder is basically, in a big company, you are hired to do a job. And the way that you need to be evaluated is based on what you're supposed to do, right? It's also, it's good for the company, it's also good for you, in the sense that there are expectations and you know what they are. And so it helps to formalize a little bit more what you're supposed to do. So if you hire the software engineers, then you have a set of things you need to do. Like, you know, you need to write code, do code review. You are less expected, for example, to do a conference, right? You don't have to be at a conference. If you do that, it's well regarded and you get credit for it, but you're not going to necessarily be part of your job description. If you're a research scientist, then your job description is very different. If you're a security engineer, which is more evaluating product, right? It's kind of like a pen tester would be your security engineer. Then your expectation is less on writing code and maybe more on testing, right? So you might have more different type of expectation. And it's important that you find a ladder who correspond to what you want to do, because at the end of the day, this is what people, it's a way to say to between the company and you to say, here's what we agree you're going to get paid to do, right? At the end of the day, it's a contract, and it's important that the contract reflect a win-win situation, right? It has to be win-win. It has to be something you like to do and something the company really wants you to do. There will always be things you might do outside of it. That might doesn't mean you only have to do that. It just means this is what your bread and butter is, and you should choose one. And you can change. You can change. I saw people going from software engineer to manager, you know, 3 years in, 4 years in, 5 years in, they realize they spend more time helping people, facilitating conversation, managing the team, managing the projects, and they want to become a manager. I saw some people going the other way around, which was being an engineering manager to become an individual contributor, right? An IC, and going back to do more technical work. I saw both ways. It's fine. It's just like you have to say what you want to do, because otherwise people have expectation that might not be what you want, and then, you know, create a lot of confusion, and that's not ideal. It also helps you to know what your career path up to the ladder, right? And so that's a very important thing to consider when you choose a job, is what is the ladder I am signing for, because it describes what your job is in a way. Also knowing that you might change, right? That's important. It's kind of a both things. So staff, as I mentioned, is F6 and above. So it just means that now, you can stay a while. That's very important. And Google can trust you that you have Google interest at heart, or Facebook trusts you, you have a Facebook interest at heart. So it's basically when you become staff, is you become, it become your company in a way. You know, in the old days, it would mean that you have more decision power and things like that. But really, the intent behind staff was you have stuck long enough and you have been able to carry successfully a few things long enough that the company now trusts you to be part of its staff, like its permanent staff or something like that. The way I would describe it externally would be tenured. It's not necessarily the same thing because you can get fired, of course, but you get that type of thing. So that's what staff really means in theory, right? I mean, it might have changed and, you know, depending on the size of the company or the stuff, but that's kind of the intent. And then, so that's more like you need to have a big success. You need to have a large impact on something which is important for the company, which usually takes a few years, and that's where you get staff. So that's how you get staff. For us, it was, we launched a bunch of internal stuff, which were very useful for the company. And so as a result of that, I became staff.
Okay.
Senior staff is like you're able to repeat multiple success on a consistent basis. And in a way, that is the last level before you become exec. So that's a proving ground where that's the last time you can have like this, there's a proving ground of like, do you have what it takes to become a director or VP? Maybe. Again, all of those are maybe, you know, it's a pyramid. So at some point you will stop. The question is, and those that like this consistent thing and you invest a lot of your time in being very successful. But then the important thing is the more you go up the ladder, the more soft skills become important. Right, because it's a lot of confidence building. It's a lot of team relationship. You interact with a lot of people. I might be still on the IC, which is individual ladder, right? I'm still a researcher, but I do have 40 meetings a week. And I'm not joking. I have 20 to 30 hours of meeting every week because I work with Gmail and I work with G Suite client and Google Cloud and this and that. And I'm really happy to do it, to be clear. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying then soft skills become very, very important.
Yeah, that's what happens when you get high enough in the ladder. Is that all your time is spent sort of showing other people what you've been working on.
Yeah, so that's what it is, and so that explains what is kind of the ladder.
Yeah. Jack, do you have anything you wanted to add to that, or?
Yeah, you know, I was just curious, kind of talking about the academic interface with, with industry, I guess. How much collaborative anti-abuse best practices do you think are shared amongst tech companies or just the industry in general versus, you know, that's more a one-way street that's coming from academia? I'm sure there's all sorts of very proprietary things that, you know, happen at Google that it wouldn't make sense competitively for that information to be shared with other companies. But I guess, like, from an academic point of view, like, how does all that work, like in anti-abuse? Do you think it's a problem, or is it, or you think it's, you know, this is a system, the interface between academia and industry that's working well, or anything you can share on your opinions of that?
Wow, it's a hard question again. But yeah, okay, I'll try. I think there are collaboration. I think there are things which works well. For example, I think tech in general is pretty good with working groups, right? I think, at the end of the day, we do interoperability, right? If you think of IT information technology, we're just pushing bits. That's kind of our job, right? We move bytes from there to there to there in a certain format. That's kind of our job, right? And we try to secure those bytes. So I think interoperability is pretty good. I think there are concerns about who can wait on those working groups, but I think there are working groups, and I think there's a lot of good open source software from Nmap, right? Which is a network vulnerability scanner, which works really well, right? I think it's developed by the community. That's fine. I think in general, research is, and that's where it's an interesting, confusing, difficult, but easy to resolve thing, which is who is a researcher? My stance is everyone who says they are a researcher is one. If you feel you do research and you feel like you're advancing state of the art one way or another, then you are a researcher, right? You know, it's a very much like a self-claimed title. It's not like, you know, it's not like academia where You have to have a PhD and you have to be in academia. I think security researcher is just someone who is trying to learn or trying to advance the field of the state of the art one way or another. And so that's why we have vulnerability researchers, right? And vulnerability researchers finding new vulnerability is they're advancing the state of the art. Or people who do, R&D, research and development is the same, right? It's not necessarily need, publication is not needed in our field. I think we have a lot of good, strong industry conferences, which are more or less technical, right? You have DEF CON, you have also Black Hat or RSA, which is a little bit more high level. And then you might have also like more closed conferences, which are more special topics. For example, botnet takes down mostly happen for good reason behind the scene, but they are also a very collaborative group, right? We could mention some of the nonprofit work on that, like Shadow Server, right? So they are collaboration. So there is collaboration for sure. I think that's good. I think we can always use more. I think the difficulty is not on the technical side. You know, most of what we use, people know. We use TensorFlow. TensorFlow is public. Where are we? TensorFlow is there. Are we using specific things? Maybe some slight improvement there and there, which are very specific to our product for sure. We use also a lot of other things, which is not AI-based. Very important anti-abuse and security is not all AI or crypto. There is a lot of things like access control, you know, incident response, reverse engineering, malware analysis, data mining. There is a lot of things in the security to keep, right? And again, one thing I was mentioning to Chris when we prepared the podcast is talking about security at Google is, are you asking how we protect Google itself or are you asking how we protect our product? Because that's not the same. Right. One is a company, might be a big company. The other one is a multi-billion user product. That's not the same. And we have different problem, both of them. I personally feel a calling to protect users. So I'm on the product side, so I can't really tell you much about our internal process.
Right.
But I think corporate security and large-scale product is very, very different, right? And so for large-scale product, which is what I know the best, we do have some technical edge. But at the end of the day, the main problem we have, and it's a very, very difficult one, is that the data we have is not ours. It's given to the user, or not given, it's actually entrusted to us by our users. It's not given, that's very important. It's actually entrusted to us by our users. We have this very, very strong line in the sand, and I would say it on record. We do not share user information. We just don't. You can come with a warrant, and then that's a different question, but is Google willing to share user data with anyone? Absolutely not. Would we ever have shared for the interest of research user data? No, we did not. We do tend to try to share aggregated statistics. You know, we sometimes publish paper on how we do machine learning for malware, or what are a lot of people, when I go to RSA, one of the favorite things people keep asking me is, how many phishing campaigns did you see? Are they targeting more Japan, or are they more targeting France, or this kind of stuff? And I think people want to know. So we can tell you statistics, and that's fine, because that's not about the user or company. It's about, you know, the whole system. That's okay, I think. And it's anonymized data with like a threshold, right? We don't go deeper. We don't want to de-anonymize people. When it comes to sharing, we will not share user data. So a lot of the things like fake accounts, out of questions. Even private data is only seen by the machine, right? So for example, for the Gmail thing, when we train a machine learning model, we don't see the email unless they are reported by a user for the specific purpose of us looking for security. And again, they are reported to us for security, which means they are used only and only to debug why the classifier might have failed. That's the job of the report. You do not, that's what the expectation is. That is what we're supposed to do. So when people say, oh, Google have a lot of data, we are interested with a lot of data, but the anti-abuse thing or security thing is we are interested to that data to make the product more secure. It's not to entertain a study. It is not to entertain a case study. That's not helping our user security, so can't do that. And the same for every other company, right? That's one kind of the thing that is very important. So something we might be able to share, and some we might not be able to share. And, you know, with regulations and things like that, there is even more constraint around data retention and things like that. So even things that you find on the internet is not yours, right? We cannot tell you, we might index the web, but the web is not ours. It's owned by other people. So we don't have the right to share it. They have to do it themselves, right? That's their job. But there is a content. We just happen to know it exists, which is a very, very different thing. So I think that the main problem with anti-abuse is it's huge on big data set, and big data set hard to build. So we hope at some point to find, and we've been working on it for a long time, I think reproducibility is a problem. I would agree that reproducibility between what company A claim and what company B claim is very hard to verify. And it's really, really difficult because we don't have those big data sets that they have for AI, right? One of the things which is very known in AI is called ImageNet moment, where Fei-Fei Li created this 14 million image data set, right? Where you could imagine, and that fueled all the research around computer vision and getting better neural networks, you know, to detect things. And that really helped the academia. We don't have those data sets yet. We're trying to find ways to do some of it. I think a lot of people, I'm sure other people are doing the same. So yes, we have a problem of reproducibility in our field. We have a problem of sharing data. The technology in security and anti-abuse is very mundane, I would say. You know, we use a lot of things from other fields, I would say. Crypto might be unique to us, but the rest of it is like, oh yeah, we use a network stack like everyone else. You want to run your own intrusion detection system. Well, you know, you're doing regular expression like everyone else, or you do machine learning like everyone else. So I don't think we have adaptation. We are more an integration field rather than a kind of like a fundamental field. Exception being we need data sets which represent the state of the world. And that's why it's really, really hard. And sometimes illegal, by the way. Right. It would never be a data set for child abuse. Right.
Right.
An example of an abuse that you need to fight when you're in a company is you don't want child abuse on the platform, but you cannot legally own or legally retain child abuse images. That's not going to work, right? So you have to work with industry, and you have to work with in the US NCMEC, right, National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, on them creating hashes, right? And then now we have a hash system to do the matching, and people say, well, why don't you do better? The answer is because that's really hard. And so I think there are constraints around data, and I think data is the number two issue in the field. We can talk about the number one issue, but the number two issue is data sharing, and there is no good easy answer. So it's all right.
Yeah. Now, I want to move over. We're getting into the realms of what anti-abuse is and what you do is in anti-abuse at Google, and so I want to sort of pivot this towards the career aspect of things, because a lot of our listeners are sort of looking for their future job. They're interested in cybersecurity industry, but they don't maybe necessarily know all the areas. So I want to sort of consolidate a few questions here and ask you a bit about what the difference, between a career in cybersecurity versus a career in, you know, anti-abuse. And also specifically, if you're interested in anti-abuse as a career, what are some things that young aspirants should be learning or doing or having on their resume, accomplishments they should have that would get them noticed, you know, say if they applied at Google or somewhere else in that type of work. What do you think in 2021 people should be sort of focusing on if they want to do the kind of work that you do?
Okay, good question. This one is easy. So I think if you do cybersecurity, it's a set of skills which are very core to the field, right? If you do cybersecurity, maybe if you start with learning about web security and you know how to secure a website, which is something which is somewhat stable at that point, you know, XSS, CSRF, SQL injection, and pen testing are things which come to mind, then it is a path. You know, you can also have the compliance path where you look more at are your infrastructure is compliant? Do you have a disaster recovery plan, access control, things like that, which are also very important, right? You maybe also have to do, to be honest, all of it if you're in a small company, right? If you have a small company, you know, you are the engineer, the security, and the CTO, right, and all at once. And, you know,
yeah,
in that
salesman,
case,
salesman, custodian, holding.
Yeah. Exactly, right? And you're holding the fort on your spare time. And sure. So in that case, you are more on the system and network path with a slant to crypto, right? So if you really know, I think in that path, I would choose to learn to be proficient in one operating system to understand how it works, you know, the basic of authentication, the basic of what is a patch checker. I think one of the big things you do in a company is how do you update things? Because you always have this problem of, am I updating and breaking things, or am I leading things around? What is a vulnerability? When should I update? You know, patch checker, patching is a very, very expensive thing, right? And so that's risk management. And I think you're managing the risk for your company. What do I back up? How much am I force backing up? An example of that would be, and then we're coming closer to abuse, is how do I secure account? Do I require two factor, right? I think one of the most important thing we can do is second factor, right? So that's, I'm taking my crypto hat here, but I think second factor is very important. Security keys is useful, very powerful, probably the best thing for protecting against phishing. Problem being, you have to distribute them. If you have a bunch of employees specifically remote, what happened when they lose their security key? Can you ship one to them? Do they need to buy one? How do you get them to recover their account? That's kind of like a law of perspective. If you're in a bigger company, then you know all those duty are separated. So you kind of like now enter the field of which branch am I? Am I into the IT side of it where I'm securing the corporation, which is like my network? And then in that case, intrusion detection, firewalls, and again, we're back to network and systems, right? Or am I working on the website or the web services? Then web security and crypto might be more interesting to you. And then abuse is user-generated content mostly, right? And so now you're like, okay, I have a e-commerce website. I might get fake review. I might get fake transaction. I might get unwanted comment. Some people might decide, you know, to upload pornography to your website, even though you don't know why, but people do that, you know. It's been, I don't know, maybe 20 years, we try to tell people to not upload porn on YouTube. There are other places and it still happened. And we still don't know why, but people really think YouTube would be good for pornography. I'm like, probably go somewhere else. So, you know, it's like, it's not like you should not do it. It's just like probably not on that product specifically, you know.
Right. Happens all the time.
It happens all the time, right. And you have user-generated content, which is not necessarily, and it's a very difficult thing, right? So in a way, cybersecurity is, in a way, zero or one, right? Is let in or let out, right? 0 to 1. And I think the 0.001 to the 0.9999 is what identity abuses. It's more on the, so in that case, you're looking more at data science track, right? So you're looking at data mining or machine learning. Not necessarily machine learning, data mining is fine too, or any kind of statistical background. So the abuse team will recruit a lot of people who have a background in data science. You know, they can learn anti-abuse in a way. Anti-abuse is just one place. I always believe that having good fundamental is the key to a good career. Good fundamental means you need to be able to be proficient at one programming language. I think that's very important in our day and age. You have to switch sometime. I started my career writing C, right? But then I arrived at Stanford, and it's all of the rage about Ruby. And I really love Ruby, but then I joined Google, and Google is like, no, we have Java, C++, Python, or Go. So I'm like, fine, I'll pick up Python, and now I'll write everything into Python. But I write code every week, right? And I can talk about that.
You can't put all your eggs in one basket. You can't just go
think. You cannot do all of them, but I think you should be comfortable with one. And Python is a data science language at that point. You have R, but it's very, very old generation in the sense of most of the newer package are on Python. Most of the machine learning framework and things. You can have backport to R, but I would say Python, you know, the data science package on Python, if you know that, if you have done a small project, you know, do a small project you like. Do you want to try to analyze CAPTCHA? They all CAPTCHA with OCR, recognize them. Do you want to look at phishing pages? Do you, you know, it's like there is Fish Tank, which is a set of free public page, a free data set you can create, right? Small data set, or do you like to have even basic experience in machine learning? Right. Do you know what TensorFlow is, or PyTorch if you are going for another route, right? Yes, I think that's that. I think you just recognize what is the fundamental you need. And I think a big company is more interested in having people who can transition job actually, because they want to recruit you and then they might recognize that you might want to change job or change focus. So then they are looking at, would you be able to perform more than what you are hired for? So another way to say it is what Donald Knuth said, which is the premature optimization is the root of all evil. And I would say early in your career, you should just be very good at one part of computer science, whether it's like, you know, data science or whether it's system and network. Both of them will serve you extremely well. Mm-hmm. Some people have a passion for system and network. Some people have a passion for data science. Some people need to do both and figure out which one they like. I did system and network for many, many years. I love data science now. I don't know where I'm going to end up in 5 years. I just know it takes 10,000 hours, right? To be honest, to be a master in your field, it's 10,000 hours of work. And so choose the one you like and you feel like you're not burned out in the morning, right? My test for people is, are you going with a smile doing in front of your computer, right? Are you smiling while you're doing things? Do you find pleasure into it? It doesn't mean it's not difficult sometimes or it's not tedious sometimes. That's okay. But at the end of the day, is it something you do enjoy? And so I would say that's a two-band track. I don't know if you guys agree. And maybe other people have other opinion, but I think system network is one track. Data science is the one which is kind of the path to anti-abuse, to be honest. That would be a sound recommendation. And if along the way you decide that you don't want to do security, but you want to do maybe more data scientists, or you want to do, I don't know, other thing like pure, more machine learning, which is also in high demand, then you can fork, right? So in a way, you're not sacrificing much.
Great.
To do data science basically project.
So we're coming up on the end on an hour here, and we could probably talk with you for hours more, but we want to let you finish your day here. But Jack, before we go, do you have any other questions for Ellie that you want to end us on?
Yeah, you know, I guess just to kind of wrap it up, one thing that I'm really curious to ask is what you feel like the future of attacking machine learning will be, you know, as AI and ML becomes a bigger part of a society and, you know, is responsible for more and more things. You know, we just saw in the news in the United States that the U.S. military is going to have autonomous drones that have no human interaction and will be fully functional with no human interaction in terms of AI. And like, you know, I just look at that kind of thing as kind of like, well, this is kind of crazy. But I guess, you know, when I think about today versus how we were 10 years ago, you can go on the dark net now and for $5,000, you can buy a very sophisticated web and phishing attack package, you know, basically a SaaS tool. Do you think, like, what does the future hold for attacking machine learning, attacking AI? And do you think that, like, in the future, in like 2025, the attack surface is going to be within machine learning primarily? Or I guess, you know, if you kind of put on your hacker hat from days past, like how do you think this will all unfold, and kind of what's the future of attacking machine learning?
All right, so that's a long question. that's a long one. We might have. I don't know if I can do it in 8 minutes. Maybe I'll take a little bit more time if you don't mind, because that's a very important question. You actually touch on the hardest question of the field, right? I think you. So there is multiple part to your question. So I'll try to go one at a time, and maybe I'll let you tell me if that makes sense to you. Because the first thing we need to go back very, 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 very at the beginning, and that's where we need to start. And I promise I'll talk to you about the GAN thing in a few minutes. I promise. But let's start with the beginning, because I think it's important to always go back to first principle. What are we trying to do? So I'll take Gmail as an example, because that's probably the most well-known and easy to conceptualize. And, you know, we can talk about that context. I think it applies to everywhere, but I think it's easier if we take a concrete example. So what are we trying to do? What we try to do is to say there is a line, and this line is what goes into your inbox or what goes into your spam box. So in a way, we try to make a binary decision. So very much like an access control of what goes in and what goes out. So we don't remove it, we put it into a spam folder, although very few people go into the spam folder. I don't know, Chris, when was the last time you looked at your spam folder?
Earlier this morning, but I'm a bit compulsive. So, but okay. your point is taken. I've lost some pretty almost lost some pretty amazing emails in a spam folder. The problem has gone that it's gone the other way around, where it's there might be something I actually need in there. But your point is taken. Anyway,
exactly right. So we make a line, right, and the line is we make them in the spam folder. There are also things which do not go into your spam folder. there are also things that we literally block, like malware. So malware don't go to your spam folder because that's too risky. We would put things in a spam folder. So now we have kind of this two line. What goes into the spam folder, what goes into your inbox. And the problem is this line do not exist. It's not like an all and nothing. It's not like you know the password, you don't know the password, or you have the security key or you don't. It's what is the intent behind what you want in your inbox. And that's what abuse is about, is how do we learn the decision boundary of the problem? That's really, if you really want to go super precise on, or like abstract and really zoom in onto what we try to do, that is our job. And so we need to learn this boundary. This boundary applies to everything. It's like if you have a form, you have to make a decision which comments are acceptable and which comments are not acceptable, which again depend on the topic, depend on the topic of the blog, depend on your audience, depend on the settings, depend on many things. So basically what abuse try to do is to use statistical learning, machine learning part of that, to infer what the decision bound is, because to be honest, we don't know. And it's not humanly trackable, right? And so that the first thing which is to understand is we can't express it with a rule, otherwise it would be what we would have done. Don't use machine learning because you want to use machine learning. Use machine learning because it is doing things you cannot do. Some people will say that machine learning is the last resort of the incompetent. For me, it's more like the last resort of the problem exceeding your brain capacity, right? I can't tell you what the boundary for Gmail is. I just know it exists. And we got good feedback from it, which is user putting things in the spam folder or putting things into their inbox. And I always mention when I have talk, and when I talk about Gmail, I have a talk on what is the challenge for AI. One of the things is how you skew your classifier to make its mistake one way or another. So for Gmail, what you also want in this boundary is also be on the right side of the decision. So what I mean by that is, as you mentioned, it's better for us to put something into your inbox that you put into your spam box, rather than put something into your spam box that you might need and put it into it that you have to go for, right? People are okay to spam folder something more than they're okay to miss an email, right? So that's a decision boundary where we have to not only draw a line in the sand, which is very, very bizarre, but we also have to make sure that when we don't know, we are cautiously falling on the right side of the boundary. In a way, you're asking, is it fail safe or is it fail open, right? Which is a big question in security. We'll tell you that most of the time you should fail safe, right? But sometimes you need to fail open, right? The firewall, if your firewall goes down, you have to decide whether you cut all network connection or you let all network connection in, right? That's kind of the decision for firewall. For us, it's, is it in the inbox or is it into the spam box? If you ask the question, what do we do for account recovery? Again, very hard to draw the line. Do you get your account back? Are we going for fail safe or fail open? If we're not sure, we're going to do the reverse, which we're going to deny and ask you to show more information, right? So again, the decision boundary is important. The way you fail to the left or to the right of it is also very important. And that's really the crux of what we try to do, right? Now, what does it mean for an attacker, right? Because that's what Jack's question, which is, what does it mean for an attacker? So now we know what we need to do. What happened? How an attacker goes about attacking such a system? Well, you can do two things. So one thing, you can try to skew the line in your favor. And we can talk about that in a second if that's of interest. Or you can decide to get us to fail into the wrong direction, right? That's kind of the two options you have, right? The reason why I mean they are different is, skewing the line means you pollute our training data set. So what you could do is attack pollution. It's not as discussed as the second one, but it's very powerful. Is, I'll give you an example. One of the things that we know spammers are doing, and you know, it's known in the dark web, they would have a lot of people take a spam campaign or a phishing campaign and have a lot of accounts, hijack account or fake account, say, this is not spam, this is not spam, this is not spam. So what they try to do is they try to add content to our training pipeline so that the boundary shifts in their favor over time. It is very, very subtle. It's hard to detect if they do it correctly because, you know, they are slowly, slowly shifting where the line is until, you know, their email goes through, right? So in a way, you are trying to because machine learning learns things and then apply it. No, it learns and generalizes. If it learned the wrong thing, then you can do that. There is this notion of backdooring models, right? So you could imagine that if you police the data set of the government, then you know it might make a wrong decision. That's a really important attack. We're back to data security and data integrity. So that become very, very difficult when you use user-generated content and reports to help you out. So in our case, we rely on our user and the help of our user to know what's wrong, right? They have the report button and they can tell us on moving things. So we rely on user action. So because now our system depends on user input, and remember, the canonical thing in security, do not trust user input is something we keep repeating. Well, here in a way, we can't trust it, but we need it. So that's where the difficulty is. That's one of the probably less understood part of the thing. Now, the thing you were mentioning, Jack, is how people get us to fail into the wrong side on a specific example, right? Adversarial example, right? So there's the other side of it. Well, then there are sophisticated and less sophisticated way to do it. There is a manual thing where we have a lot of botnets as a service, right? We also have what we call FUD, fully undetectable document, where they try to do mutation, obfuscation, encryption. You know, there was this campaign this week on people using Morse code to decode some of the payload. It was completely crazy. You know, people try to evade, right? You can write handcrafted rules, and most of the time you use the attacker use their own intuition on how to attack your system, right? And so that is what pen testing would be, where you use your intuition on how to break a network. Similarly, you can have a pen testing on how to evade a classifier or an antivirus and use, you know, arcane features of file format, right? That's a known thing. If you're an expert into a document, you say, okay, Excel has this very old thingy. Excel macro 4 is a big thing this year, right? With a lot of APT relying on it. It's a very arcane thing, which is very old from Excel. It turns out that attacker knew about it. Some detection system did not. So, you know, you bypass, right? That's an example of that. Now, the question is, can you use machine learning to actually create example that can bypass the system? So the sad news is, at the end of the day, and that is a theorem, actually. So, you know, that's kind of like the impeding feature. The answer is yes. It's called GA network, right? Generative adversarial network, which is this idea of having two networks which fight each other. One generate content, the other one detect it. There is a term which says at the end of the day, the one who generates content ultimately win, right? So that is what is used for deepfake, right? And you can use deepfake, you know, for non-safe work things, which is the one which is the most in the press. You can also use it for disinformation, where they try to create, you know, a video of or a photo of X with Y, talking to Y, or X saying something. And those deepfakes are a big problem because then it's hard to know what to trust. So you can build a detector. So you can build, and that's where a lot of the research in machine community is on how to detect those things, right? So there are glitches because the AI is not perfect. But at the end of the day, yes, you will be able to use that to evade a machine learning classifier. And at the end of the day, we think that any classifier is evadable. So it's a cat and mouse game for now. At the end, but when is the end? I don't know. Not now, for sure. You will be the generator overpowering the detection system. So the question is, what do you do next? That's also in the active research area. But that also have interesting area of research, which are, there's a paper by CMU on how to use actually adversarial network to evade detection. Right. So if you put the right shape of glasses, a paper by Lu Zhou, a really good paper where they show that if you put the right lenses, then the eye don't see you or make you believe you are someone else. So you can use those techniques also for fooling recognition. So in a way, what you do with the technique is also up to you. And some of it has good application because some people might not want to be on facial recognition. Right. Some people might want to not have their. So, yeah, that's where we are. I hope that answers the question.
That's really a lot of food for thought there, I think. It's going to be interesting, like you say, kind of rat race, arms race for the next couple of years. So,
But we had that for exploits, right? you know, if we were talking at the beginning to circle back and close on the, you know, back to the root, in when buffer overflow or format rebug came out, there was no defense, right? You would, yep. You would write a buffer format buffer overflow. There was no canaries. There was no randomized tags. There was no depth, right? And then people started to come up with defenses, and then you started to have return-oriented programming, and then, you know, defense seemed to overcome attackers for a while, and, you know, people were like, okay, exploit is dead, right? And then circle back, now exploit is, again, the attacker have the upper hand, and probably it's going to go down again. And it's just the nature of security. If you're not a player and you don't like the cat and mouse game, and you don't like the constant learning and the constant reimagination, that's a hard field to be in.
Yes.
We keep inventing new defense and new attacks, and that's the cycle of it, which also explains why at some point you may be tired of it. You know, maybe after 30 years of keeping track every morning, maybe you're like, okay, I'm done. That's also a tiring side of it, but I think it's also an exciting side. It's like
very real, yeah.
Always new things. Mm-hmm. So yeah, today there is new attack, new defense, so it means there's always room for new people, and as you come to the field and you take one side of it, and that would be my last advice, is take one small bit. Don't worry about the big picture. Yep. I mean, you can learn about it, but just take one you like. Take car hacking, take website security, take machine learning security if you would. Phishing classification, whatever you want. Do one you really like, go deep, learn about it, advertise it, write a blog about it or something like that. Post it on social network.
There you go.
And then you will learn and you will enter the community that way. And who knows where it leads, and you'll get opportunity. That I'm sure of.
I think that's an excellent piece of advice to end off the show here today. So Ellie Burstyn, I mentioned it before, but I know that that your website, ellie.net, is probably the best place for our listeners to find you. Is there anything else you would like to direct them to?
If they want to have some news about security or some news about what Google is doing, I tweet that on Twitter. It's ELIE, right?
And same. ELIE. Yep.
Yeah, I was one of the first people to work at Twitter.
So okay, there you go.
I got my form.
My
preferred username. Yes,
yeah, yeah. No, Ellie 1974 or anything like that. Okay. Well, I want to thank you again for sharing your time and insights today with us, Ellie, and thank you also, Jack, for joining us today. Do you have any final announcements you want to mention about InfoSec or anything else?
No. Just thanks so much for being on the podcast, and you know, thanks, Chris, for, another fantastic episode. So
my pleasure.
A lot of fun being on your show.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both again for your time. And as always, thank you to our listeners for listening and watching. I just want to point out that new episodes of the CyberWork podcast are available every Monday at 1 p.m. Central, both on video at our YouTube page and on audio wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. I also want to mention, don't forget to check out our hands-on training series titled CyberWork Applied. Tune in as expert InfoSec instructors teach you a new cybersecurity skill and show you how that skill applies to real-world scenarios. It's all free, and so you go to infosecinstitute.com/learn to stay up to date on all things CyberWork. Thank you once again to Ellie Burstyn. Thank you to Jack Koziel, and thank you all again for watching and listening. We'll speak to you next week. How about some free cybersecurity training resources for you and your team? Just go to infosecinstitute.com/free to get ebooks, training guides, and more than 100 cybersecurity training courses, all free for CyberWork listeners. Go to infosecinstitute.com/free and start learning crucial new skills today.